You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. You're listening to More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Today is Monday, the 16th of January in the year 2006. The time is approximately 7:42, and we welcome you to our morning show.
Yes, indeed. Good morning, good morning.
Joining us today will be a somewhat frequent guest of ours.
Yeah, I guess this is about the fourth time we've had him on, maybe more.
Who is the publisher of BlackCommentator.com.
Along with Peter Gamble, he handles the presses, so to speak. I guess it's the virtual press, though.
The virtual press.
Yes.
But the virtual has become the real.
Well, virtually
that post-modernism,
speaking.
Postmodernism thing.
It's not semantics?
It's more than. It's reality.
Hey, it's real, virtually. But anyway, we're expecting to have our guest today. He will be on momentarily. It sounds as though we have him now. Will you go ahead and announce him? I have one quick thing to grab.
Okay, joining us this morning is Glenn Ford, publisher of BlackCommentator.com. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, and I'm co-publisher. That's Peter Gamble is another publisher.
Okay, we don't want to leave out Mr. Gamble. Thank you for joining us again this day. How are you?
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Great, great. I just came across an article. I just want to read a little bit of it and then want your feedback. It's an article by Jeff Paris, who's a Seattle-based columnist and reporter. And again, he's writing about Martin Luther King, and he says in part, the saddest loss in the modern narrative of Dr. King's career is the story of who he was, a man without wealth, without elected office, who managed as a single individual to change the world simply through the strength of his moral conviction. His power came from his faith and his willingness to act on what he knew to be right. This story could inspire many millions to similar action. If only it were told, we could each be Dr. King. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., nonviolent martyr to reconciliation and justice, has become a hallmark card, a warm, fuzzy, feel-good invocation of neighborliness, a foul photo for sneakers or soda commercials, a reprieve for post-holiday shoppers, an excuse for a three-day weekend, a cardboard cutout used for photo ops by dissembling cabinet members and ungrateful Supreme Court justices. Be sure to check out the three-day-only white sale at Walmart. Always a better price, always. King deserves better. We all do.
Well, it's quite clear that the commodification of Dr. King is a project that's been underway for a long time. And the use of camp of Dr. King to bamboozle everybody in this country, the use by those who would be most hostile to Dr. King, is probably the most cynical thing you can think of. However, the author is a little bit simplistic in his description of Dr. King. Dr. King was an intensely political person. He was an organizer of the largest mass movement the nation had ever seen. He was a minister and deep in the matrix of black church politics in the South. Which was the only kind of politics that that black folks were allowed to engage in the 1950s. So he's a much more complicated political person than the author described him in the beginning of that piece.
Yes, and I just shared a short piece of it, and he goes further into it, but I think you raised some great points that we want to discuss this morning. Celeste?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that we see with the current administration having hijacked it, I guess you could say, is the whole idea of a faith-based community actually coming together, coalescing for power. But with King, as you mentioned, there was quite a bit of depth to it, because what you had was a leader who was amassing the political capital of black America through their faith-based organizations to make a really, I guess the best way I can describe it is a quantum leap in terms of political organizing and social consciousness, taking the faith-based organizations and making an attack on American imperialism. And I see that as the next level of what King's work would have been. We sit here right now, we talk about what was his dream, we try to celebrate the dream, but I don't think a lot of people realize how truly controversial King was about to become, and how once he had made some of the preliminary steps at gaining rights for Black Americans, which is also going to be the platform for everybody to be free in this country, truly, at least, you know, in terms of your spirit, he was making that quantum leap and organizing the churches, organizing poor people, organizing across ethnic lines to make an attack on our desire to basically rule the world. And that is one of the things that I think I wanted to not only discuss with you today, but to actually use to propel ourselves into thinking, where would he be if he were here now? What kind of work would King be doing? What is his true legacy?
You know, for the last 10 years or so, the right wing and corporate project has been to create a new Black leadership to replace the old Black leadership, and their line in this campaign is that the civil rights type leadership is now passé, ineffective, that its time has passed. The reality here is that Dr. King, who personifies civil rights leadership, had already gone forward by 1967. By 1967, the civil rights legislative agenda was already all but complete. The last major civil rights bill came in 1968. That was the Fair Housing Act. But in 67, except for the Fair Housing Act, that job was done. And King knew that very well. And he wrote a book, which was called Where Do We Go From Here? And in that book, he outlined what he called the triple evils that faced not just the Black people of the United States, but the people of the world. And he said that those triple evils were racism, economic exploitation, and war. He had already moved past the civil rights agenda that had already been successfully completed. So even Dr. King, after having largely completed that phase of the task, had already gone beyond civil rights. But where he was going was a different place. Dr. King was a left social democrat, quite clearly. He was an internationalist. He talked about Black people getting into the same spirit as brothers and sisters in Africa and Asia and the Caribbean and South America. Dr. King certainly was for Black electoral activity. He was largely responsible for Black electoral activity being possible, you know, for the passage of the 1965 Civil Rights Act. But he didn't exhort people to confine themselves to voting every 2 or 4 years. He was a mover of masses of people. He was in favor of Black folks engaging in capitalism. That's their democratic right. Nothing wrong with that. That's all to the good. But he never preached about that at any length. That was not going to be the salvation of Black Americans or the world, and he cared about the world. And he was also in favor of corporations treating Black folks right, that Black folks should be promoted and reach high position in American corporations. But he never dwelt on that too much. That wasn't going to help too many people for a few Black folks to become vice presidents of this or that corporation. But we see that King was a mover of masses of people in a distinctly left and internationalist direction. And that movement was stopped dead with the bullet that killed him. And his those who came after him, and I'm speaking of aspiring business folk and aspiring office holders, effectively shut down the movement and have his, and should bear as much blame for the shutting down of the movement as COINTELPRO and other official government actions.
We're speaking with Glenn Foer, co-publisher of BlackCommentator.com, this morning on the legacy of Martin Luther King. In your comments around Martin Luther King and how he was and continue to be at the end of his life, left us center politically. You mentioned those who came after him who sought to hijack his legacy. I would appreciate your comment in terms of he being a controversial figure within the movement throughout most of his career, his running with the Jackson of the Black Baptist Convention, and towards the end of his life, as he was organizing the Poor People Campaign, there was confrontation or conflict within his own inner circle about whether or not he should engage in those type of activities, and there was a conflict within SCLC about the direction of the future movement. Could you comment on those?
Well, we saw that those tendencies then realized themselves after his death. We know that Jesse Jackson was determined to gravitate towards hobnobbing with the corporations. And he got a taste of that with Operation Breadbasket, which he then transformed into his own Operation Push. We saw that Andy Young, who was the great negotiator in King's team, went on immediately into grooming himself for electoral and appointed political position. Hosea Williams, and he's the team member that I knew best, found himself later on becoming a Republican. Now, not a real Republican, but a messing with the Democrats Republican. So
one of those subversive Republicans.
So we see that without King as the anchor, all these tendencies became centrifugal within his team. What he did is he put together really great specialists. Everyone had a there was a division of labor that was truly wonderful, with Hosea Williams stirring up the masses and going right to the brink of violating nonviolence. I saw him in action many times, and he would bring neighborhoods to the boiling point in order to create conditions in which there would be a level of confrontation with the police. And of course, Andrew Young was the great negotiator. That's how he went on to become ambassador to the UN briefly. And Jesse Jackson, well, he can talk somebody out of a dime or a million. That was his special forte, in addition to his youthful good looks. So Martin Luther King was not just an organizer of masses, but a skillful organization man in terms of putting together his team.
Well, even with him having organized a crack team, as you described them, during his last days in his organization there, it seemed that it was really hard for him to get his supporters, get his team moving and doing the Poor People's March, as though the whole idea of uniting poor people across racial lines, and in many ways, even though it was the Poor People's March, across economic lines, was too much of a class war and made him a little bit too much of a socialist. And, you know, for some people, that made him look, dare I say, communistic. But how was it that, given the fact that his team had such skill and such vision, they still had a hard time grasping the need for the march and how important it was to have this economic uplift?
Well, we do see in hindsight that there were these very distinct tendencies at work. And not having been a fly on the wall, I cannot even speculate as to how that played out internally. But the larger external picture is certainly much more important. Once the the legislative civil rights agenda had been achieved. The corporate media declared that the struggle was over and became increasingly hostile to Dr. King. And since the movement had been so media dependent, so police dog and fire hoses dependent, so pricking the conscience of the country, and most of this country does not have a very good conscience, this transition was bound to be a very, very difficult one, and it was.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio here on the air at 90.7 FM in the Portland metropolitan area, 91.9, and the Columbia River Gorge, White Salmon, Washington, Hood River, Oregon, and Corvallis, Albany, and Salem. It is 100.7. And on the web, you can find KBOO at kboo.fm. More Talk Radio here with Cecil and myself, Celeste. And we're speaking with Glenn Ford, who is the co-publisher of theblackcommentator.com, an online opportunity to read between the lines, especially with information news that affects people of color globally, actually the world, if we stop for a moment and listen. We're talking today about what is the actual legacy. What is some of the aspects of King's legacy that perhaps we are overlooking in the haste to have a commercialized celebration? Too often, so much of the celebration, as Cecil mentioned in the beginning of the article, is kind of gestures made without any real anchor in what King actually looked at, what he saw when he went to the mountaintop. And yes, he saw, as our guest Glenn Ford pointed out, civil rights, rights for black Americans to be able to vote, to be able to acquire property, jobs, to participate in free market capitalism such as it is. But the point was also that he was a very savvy organizer who saw beyond all of this to the next level. And the next level was how he was organizing not only within the faith-based constituency, but that he was organizing across ethnic lines, across economic lines, maybe even in some people's minds across party lines. But most importantly, he was looking at making an attack on American imperialism, looking at how our fighting in the Vietnam War was not only immoral and unjust, but doomed to failure because, as he felt, no empire was going to be able to sustain itself in an immoral war, in an immoral effort. We will be opening the phone lines here momentarily. The phone number is 503-231-8187. So if you want to call, you can line up the queue now. And let me take a look at an engineer. Okay, good. We don't have any calls yet. Okay.
I'd like to elaborate on what happened after King's death.
Go right ahead.
And the rise of the business class, black business class, or aspiring black business class.
Okay.
And the black political class, as in electoral politics, mm-hmm. And why they shut down the movement. And it's really quite logical. If you are an aspiring politician, you certainly want the masses to vote for you, but you don't want an active mass, actively political community after you win office, because they become a nuisance, an impediment. They make demands upon you because you are now the mayor. And so you have an interest in defanging that movement, even if you rode into office largely on the strength of mass black political activity. If you are of the business class, you look at other black people as, if you were a retailer of some kind, simply as consumers. You don't want to risk disruption any more than your white business counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
If you are trying to climb the corporate ladder, well, you know what kind of conversation you have to be engaged in that kind of environment. And yet these are the elements that, after King's death, got into the catbird seat in black America. And again, it is quite ironic that those elements who remain in basically in charge, to the extent that anybody's in charge, are now referred to by the corporate media, the corporate paid blacks in their service, and the right-wing think tanks who write the script as being civil rights types, when in fact they are nothing like a civil rights type in the way that Dr. King was before his transition, and certainly have little in common with his left social democratic goals and dreams in the latter part of his life.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. The number is 503-231-8187. And we got a few folks here online, so let's go to our callers. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Celeste.
Good morning.
You know what I'm going to say? This is my reminder that it was the Empire that killed Martin Luther King. They assassinated him. According to Dick Gregory, the shooter was a Memphis police officer named Earl Clark. The CIA was involved in it, the FBI, the city of Memphis, and the New Orleans mafia boss, Carlos Marcello. In 1999, a lot of people don't realize this. In 1999, the King family filed a civil lawsuit against Lloyd Jowers, who was a cafe owner in Memphis, and other conspirators, and the result of this was they got a verdict from a civil jury in Memphis that Dr. King was killed by a conspiracy involving Lloyd Jowers and government agencies. It's on record, and so I don't know. I don't see how people can let this rest. I mean, it keeps bugging me all the time, you know. And so that's why I keep reminding people every chance I get.
All right. Well, thanks for your call. We appreciate the alarm pair.
Okay. You bet.
Any comments, Glenn?
Well, I'd like to share an anecdote from that period. When Dr. King was killed, I was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division. And we were in the field in Fort Bragg. My platoon was a security and light recon platoon for the headquarters division. On the Wednesday, the day before King was killed, we all noticed that the officers down to the company level had been gathered in the general's tent. And what they were doing was studying maps of Washington. And that weekend, we were all in Washington.
Mm-hmm. That's deep, and you know, too often people want to accuse black folk of being conspiracy theorists and paranoid, and you know, and being so quick to jump to outlandish conclusions. But you know, all you have to do is connect the dots. Quite often, now you know the caller sometimes is amazed the fact that not enough black people get upset because there's a conspiracy behind King's death. And I've told him, I said, it's because we live constantly with the idea of organized oppression. So, you know, why would we be surprised? And what is going to be gained by pursuing those who perpetrated his death and perpetrated the conspiracy? And you just point out yet another, you know, possible link here. And you know, to what end would we pursue something like that? I mean, there comes a point where you just say, uh-huh, yep, a bunch of folks got together, planned it, and did it, and there it is.
Oh, no, we must continue to pursue and to highlight and to educate. That's part of the education process, part of the politicization process. Probably more important now than ever, since that same type of government is in power now,
yes.
Trying to usurp the King legacy and distort it and turn it to its own ends. So it's probably more important now than it's ever been to say, wait a minute, the U.S. government killed King. And there is no statute of limitations on political murder or murder of any kind. So this is still an open case. Pursue that.
We're speaking this morning with Glenn Ford, co-publisher of blackcommentary.com. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. The topic of conversation this morning is the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. And we'll go to our next phone caller at this time. Thank you for waiting.
Yeah, hello. I'm seen personally by some people as pessimistic, cynical, et cetera, et cetera. But I was wondering if you or other people in this country believe it's really possible to raise a social consciousness of any of the races or classes in this country with all the spiritual and mental pollution we have in us from advertising, TV, and I believe computers too, contribute to it, fast pace, instant gratification. Do you or anyone really believe our social consciousness can be really raised to a healthy level? Thank you.
I have for some time wondered if the human animal is really up to this kind of assault by media. And I'm not just talking about commercials. I'm talking about the ubiquitousness of media. You know, we're basically the same animal as we were 100,000 years ago. We evolved into modern human beings, and we were well evolved by that time. And we have not changed much. Mm-hmm. And yet that was a world in which hunting and gathering was our occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to sit still, waiting for some game to pass by or a predator to move on. The quality of patience that is required if you're gathering berries in the woods.
The quality of attention that you have to pay if you're waiting for a predator to leave.
That's
you
right.
Know,
yes,
bring up a valuable point.
And we became successful organisms because we were good at that. And now we are bombarded relentlessly with all of these images. It really is not that important whether these images are good for us or not. You know, many people now believe that attention deficit disorder really does exist. It's not something that white middle class folks just make up, and that it is a product of media. We know that young people do not have attention spans. It's very difficult to organize now, not just because of the erasure of history that the media routinely does, but because of the constant laying on of images of all kinds, so that the brain gets wired in ways that are not conducive to thought.
It's almost as though we're programmed to have incomplete synaptic activity. You know, in other words, you only have a shortened thought, you know, kind of an abrupt, aborted thought. You don't have a deep thought process. And you're not given enough time really to keep developing those kind of synaptic pathways. You know, somebody gives you a 30-second sound bite, and that's a lot nowadays.
Yes. We are what we experience, and our brains are shaped by those experiences, and our experiences are largely now electronic, and that cannot be good. We already see the fruits of it. And in terms of, if we want to get down to the narrow subject of political organizing, it's become exponentially more difficult.
Well, speaking of, in terms of political organizing, in terms of the impact of media today, if we reflect back 40 years ago, we see people like Lewis and Nash, young, early 20s, late teens organizers who did incredible organizing, and maybe it was because of their background or their influences. Are there ways in which we can adapt or learn some of the not only tactics but also some of the inspiration that James Lawson inspired into a young generation 40 years ago?
Well, let me answer that sideways, obliquely, by way of a comment. We're all discussing this hip-hop generation. Let me show my credentials here so that I can be allowed to have an opinion.
All right.
I owned and operated the first hip-hop radio syndication, Wrap It Up, from 1987 to 1993. So I know a little bit of something about this. But this construct, this hip-hop generation, which, based on some definitions, may be 42 or 43 years old by now, can be reached. But those black organizational leaders who attempt to reach the younger age group or pretend to attempt to reach them pander to them as if they must, all they have to do is play some hip-hop music, and that is like rubbing the bottle and the genie pops up.
Mm-hmm.
That has nothing to do really with it. Certainly in terms of the style of approach to young people, we know that they want faster answers, that they must be engaged, that they can't stand a long speech, even if you have the best speaker in the world, that you have to devise hooks and tricks, that in short, that they have that their brains are wired with shorter attention spans. That we understand, but there must be substance in your hooks and your tricks to be placed in the foreground.
Absolutely.
of that hip hop background, and that's not what's happening, and so the real failure here, of course, is in the lack of vision of those who are trying to organize.
In terms of their organizing the young people, though, to kind of move further on what you were saying, you do have to have some substance. You actually have to have a point, because they're not empty-headed. But we still saw some large inroads made into the youth community with this last election. So there has to be some type of really strong political sensibility, some really strong sense of a need for social justice. So,
well, I must interrupt here.
Mm-hmm.
Among black youth, by far, the chief concern is mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's among black females as well, because that's, they know quite well why they don't have enough suitable mates,
mm-hmm.
And prospects for marriage.
Or broken families.
And certainly black males, for reasons we don't even have to elaborate on, know that mass incarceration is the chief bane in their lives. And yet the leadership, such as it is, seems to be more ashamed that so many black people are going to jail, a million in behind bars at any given moment, more ashamed than outraged. And until they tackle mass black incarceration, they will make very few inroads among youth. That's the substance that is missing on these agendas.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7. The phone number is 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Glenn Ford, who is co-publisher of theblackcommentator.com, and you are on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two questions. First one is this, and I'm putting this to the listeners as well as your guests there. Does Condoleezza Rice represent an example of the Martin Luther mandate being fulfilled? The second question is, was Condoleezza Rice the most qualified for her position when she was selected?
Number one, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and the other appointees, and George Bush has a better record of black appointments than any president that came before him, which shows that that black appointments don't mean much in terms of public policy.
And well, it also shows how savvy you can be in taking care of surface issues.
That's very important because there was a sea change that came about within the right sometime in the mid-90s. You can't put an exact date on things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it became apparent in the mid-90s that the right had finally gotten over a level of rabid racism. That is the level in which they could not stand for more than one, if one, black person in the room. They realized that was holding them back. There have always been black folks who were out there to be bought and co-opted, but there were no buyers.
Well, not just that.
In the mid-90s, the Republicans decided we'll be the buyers.
Yep,
and we have the money.
That's right.
We need to go with our strength. We've got the money, so we let's buy. And so they began two things. One is a very aggressive black appointments strategy in order to split the black vote, but primarily in order to assuage the swing white voter who did not want to think of him or herself as a racist.
Exactly.
You put Condoleezza and Colin in the mix, and they feel all right voting Republican. They don't feel any guilt. And that's worth a lot more votes than than the number of blacks you might peel off by having a black face in a high place.
But with regard to the caller's question as to whether Condoleezza constitutes the a fulfillment of the King mandate, you know, toward expansive black participation, and whether or not she's qualified. Now,
you know,
she is no dummy. I may not like her politics, but you cannot fault her mental acumen. She's not a dummy.
Well, Colin Powell is not a dummy either, but he's a war criminal.
Yeah, well.
And so is Condoleezza Rice. All of these people should be brought to The Hague.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd rather not talk about how smart she is.
Right.
You know, I think Hitler was a very smart guy.
I don't, but I hear you.
I think he was.
He was well marketed.
All right, then. He was smart enough to go along with the program. He was
there you go.
Effective.
Yes.
That's not how he'll be known by history.
Right.
He'll be known by his crimes.
Right.
And so should Condoleezza and Colin be known by their crimes. Now, we keep on talking about, all of us have this tendency to talk about King's legacy and King thought and stuff like that. But I think we need to be clear that King was working within what we, a black commentator, call the black consensus.
Mm-hmm.
Black folks have always been against U.S. foreign adventures. Black folks have always been against U.S. imperial wars, especially when they, as usual, are directed against other people of color. We identify with those targets of the U.S. military who are people of color. So that kind of consciousness was certainly abroad in black America during King's day. Black people have always been social democrats. We were freed by politics, not by
moral persuasion.
Not by moral persuasion, and certainly not by the capitalist system, which treated us as goods.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has always been that kind of consciousness. We must understand that under the brief Reconstruction governments in the South, the first real public school systems emerged. That's because of a black consciousness that briefly was allowed to influence the political fate of the South. So King did not invent these things. King came out of that milieu. King was vigorously representing and articulating the general black political consensus of our people.
You know, you said something that was really interesting, and I'm going to see if I can capture both of them. One was the fact that if you really look at black political consciousness as it was evolving during that time, it was more of a socialistic perspective. And then there was the fact that you also mentioned that as we perceive war and American imperialism, we are not as a community supporting it. And it's not just because we identify with people, but also because, and to this day, this is still a battle cry, our needs are not being met here at home. Why are we going somewhere else to fight for the things that we don't have? And that was something that was experienced by many a returning black servicemen who could not receive the benefits of things like GI loans, for example, or getting your education without a lot of hassle, without a lot of headache, without continued struggle.
That is the experience, and that was the black conversation after every war.
Every war, right.
After the Civil War, after the Spanish-American War, after World War I, after World War II, after Korea. It is the constant refrain.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7, and if you want to partake in the conversation, the phone number is 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Glenn Ford of blackcommentator.com, and you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I feel that the prison industrial complex and the military industrial complex are the tools of those three evils Dr. King talked about, and a manifestation of those evils. And I think that he would be not too happy right now. However, if he had lived, maybe things may have taken a different turn, and that's why he was assassinated. And as far as the young people go, they're impatient with the hypocrisy. And the hip-hop artists that I know speak about that hypocrisy in their words all of the time. They see the injustice, not only on the national level, but right here in their city. The imperialism in their own city. And as long as the quote-unquote leaders that they know locally in their own city don't get it, they're going to continue to be impatient. And I don't blame them. I spoke to one young artist who went to a Damian Marley concert here in Portland, and he said it was life-changing for him to see older Caucasians and young thugs in the same venue appreciating the truth in the music that Damian Marley was providing, and it gave him hope. So, as Dr. King and everybody says, we have to keep hope alive. But I read Dr. King's letters from Birmingham jail where the other ministers were telling him he's moving too fast. It's not the right time. And that's where the politics came in. And he writes about his journey to nonviolence and how he came about it. And the dream speech is one speech. There is so much more to his vision. And I know, and as we know, he was opposed to the Vietnam War, and he would be opposed to this criminal war in Iraq. So I have hope with the young people. They can see the truth. They just don't know how, where to go. The adults aren't dealing with it. The adults are ignoring it, and they see it. But there is hope. And I don't know the answers, but I do not want the young people to be dismissed or exploited, and I'm tired of seeing them all go into prison. There's evil, as Dr. King called it, taking place right now, and we need to figure out a way to stop it. And it might be with love, as he said, and forgiveness. And I'm trying to figure out how in the world one can forgive a warmonger such as Dick Cheney, but maybe there's a way. Anyway, I got to go.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for your call.
Hello.
Hi, Glenn. Yes,
yes.
Go ahead.
The caller is absolutely correct that there is a basic raw consciousness of the oppression and of the hypocrisy and sometimes general worthlessness of black leadership among the youth. What's missing is a message and a style of work in dealing with youth. Now, I was inspired in the spring of 2004 by the National Hip-Hop Political Convention that was convened in Newark, New Jersey. And about 1,200 young people paid their own way to Newark, many of them registering voters all along the way in the buses that they were using to arrive from various cities from across the country. And they were serious. They were not frivolous. They were not there for the music, although there was music. They were attempting to tackle the burning issues of the day. And it was inspiring. It was not a Russell Simmons event. Nobody was marketing goods.
You're talking about a grassroots with a true political agenda.
That's right. These young folks were deadly serious, but they were not young nerds. These were hip young people with some degree of political consciousness and a deep political desire. That is a desire for change. And they talked about mass incarceration all the time. And I just want to say this. Mass incarceration was the U.S. answer to the civil rights and black power movements. And it is and I say the U.S. answer. I didn't just say the U.S. government. That's the white American answer to the movement of the 60s and early 70s. And we know this because the growth in black mass incarceration is nationwide. It is almost uniform. Some states are worse than others. But, for example, the worst place to be black in terms of going to jail is Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's not Alabama or Texas.
Well, explain that, because that's surprising, but it's also frightening if it's worse than Texas.
worse than Texas, because there are fewer blacks in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and they are concentrated, and mm-hmm. so this urge to incarcerate as many blacks as possible can be targeted on a mass of black folks in Milwaukee. You can identify them. Whereas in Alabama and Texas, black folks are all over the place, and it's not as easy to concentrate. So where they can find compact areas packed with black folks, they move. but black folks are all over Alabama.
Dispersed and diffused, and not concentrated.
Right. But we can see now Wisconsin's supposed to be a relatively progressive state. And you wouldn't think that that would be the case. But,
well, that's another
that
reason why
volumes,
I'm asking. Right.
That tells volumes about the real state of America. And as I said, it developed uniformly. So beginning around 1973 is when we see the stats increasing. And by now, as we said, at any given moment, a million black people are in jail. That's the consequence of a policy and a political feeling that's damn near universal in the United States.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO, and we're speaking with Glenn Ford. You can join in the conversation, 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. If you guys really want to understand the mass incarceration of black men in this country, you need to look at yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I'm saying is because the leadership of the civil rights movement has raised young black men to be filled with hatred. And then you mix that with drugs and you get very antisocial people.
Racists are the most antisocial people of them all. And I felt a little flash of that hate that you just talked about.
You guys
just
are
a second
racist.
Ago.
You guys are racist. You're no different than the Ku Klux Klan. You're no different than the Nazis.
Actually, we're quite different because to be a racist, you have to have power. And in this country, no matter how big of a voting bloc you have of Black Americans, we don't control enough of anything to be racist. We might be bigoted as a group, but if you really look at the definition of racism, it has to do with having institutionalized, structured economic and political power to be able to oppress people. You know, and actually, I'm listening to your conversation here, and I'm wondering
You're too frightened to face what's going on.
I'm too frightened to face what, caller?
You are too frightened to face that the problem is within the Black community and why you guys will not face it. The hatred. You know, I was born in 61. I came of age. You know, I was never raised to. I'm a white man. I was never raised to hate Black people. I went to the
until
East
now.
In the late 70s, and I would run off sidewalks by carloads of Black kids in lowrider Chevys.
Okay, let me pose something to you, and then I'd like to hear Glenn's comment as well. Given what you're describing, it sounds to me to be a reactive expression. This hate that you're saying fills the community. First and foremost,
I saw it in the late 70s when that rap was going.
Okay.
In New York City.
Caller, do you want to dialogue or do you want to shout me down?
I was there. I saw the hatred. I saw the hatred in their eyes.
You saw everybody.
I saw my friends getting knifed in the back by Black people for no reason. I saw it.
Hello?
Are you there?
I'm wondering if Celeste is there. And
if she can hear me.
Guys,
I'm surprised you have the courage to listen to what I have to say.
Yeah, I'm here. We're having a little technical issue here with modulation. You know, the thing that I'm trying to say, caller, is this. If you can kind of like, you know, ratchet it down a little bit here. I can't speak to your experiences, and I would like to say that I doubt seriously that you have experienced the entire country's Black population's issues. I doubt that seriously.
I was a drug addict. I was on the streets. I was on the streets with the Crips and the Bloods. I'm one of the white guys that hung out with those people, okay?
Okay, I still hear what you're saying, but I still say that, and then you further qualify by saying that you still only hung out with marginal people.
All right, okay, so
you know, my point is that you're talking about a reactive experience. People who have been oppressed and have been marginalized are not always pretty people.
That's right.
So, you know,
what I'm saying is the civil rights movement made those people filled with rage and hatred.
No, dear, I think slavery and oppression made those people filled with anger, and the civil rights movement was just one way that people tried to deal with that rage and that anger. By the time, let's see, you said in the 60s, so we're talking, I don't know, Glenn, what do you think, about 350 years of slavery and oppression?
It's almost 400. Remember?
Okay, also, okay, about 400 years. I think that probably what you were looking at was inherited rage, inherited anger, inherited frustration?
Celeste.
Yes, Glenn.
You're talking to a white man who claims to have hung out with Crips and Bloods.
I know.
And yet he's alive, and he says Black people are full of hate.
I know.
We have the most accepting community in the country.
And I don't think he got your point.
white people get hurt in the Black community, and they're all over the Black community. It's for economic reasons. It's the white folks who kill each other for blind hatred in school. They ought to look to their community.
You know, and then, too, my concern is, okay, I'm not going to deny that there are very bigoted Black people out there who will do you harm just as soon as look at you. But I'm really curious if a person has spent this kind of quote-unquote quality time with people enough to understand what the issues are, that they were unable to build a bridge and have a dialogue. And I'm listening to the whole way that this conversation was approached, and I'm thinking, well, I can see why you would have problems here, because you're not speaking to somebody in hopes of having a dialogue, you know, of trying to reach some type of mutual accord. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 here, and we hope we can at least have a conversation with folks. We don't have to reach mutual accord, but it would be good. You can join in the conversation, 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Well, good morning. How are you guys?
Just fine. How about yourself?
I'm wonderful. I just got finished listening to James speak.
Uh-huh.
James is a frequent caller to KBLO.
Well, I'm glad you've got some place to go.
Okay, James is also calls himself a libertarian conservative.
Mm.
Okay? The reason that James rants and doesn't know how to communicate is because James loves to push your buttons. James is one of those kind of guys who's got so much anger and hatred built up inside of him for whatever reasons he has, okay, and that I really do believe he just blows off steam by being angry, all right? Now, James, I got to straighten you out on one thing. James's attitude is the same as the attitude of a lot of white folks during the Hurricane Katrina thing,
mm-hmm.
where white folks were looking for food and black people were looters.
Yes.
I think that pretty much encapsulates James' mindset.
Yeah, that's very good.
I think you just shine a big ray of light here. You know, the biggest problem you have is just the whole approach. When you come in with bristles all out, you know, and ready to jab someone conversationally, I think you pretty much pointed out you're not looking for a conversation or dialogue or meeting of the minds. You're just looking to injure and afflict some pain.
Mm-hmm.
And judging by the way, you know, he started out the conversation, well, if you people want to understand your problem,
right.
I have to agree that he's got some issues he needs to tend to himself.
No, the poor man's got a problem, I swear. I'm a frequent caller to the show, and I really enjoy listening to him because he really is sort of the catalyst with his rant to spark a conversation for other people. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Now, just a couple of quick points. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. King, in his Riverside Church speech, all right, pointed out that civil rights is meaningless without justice. And unfortunately, being the government of the United States of America loves to show you one thing and does the opposite, right?
Mm-hmm.
There can't be justice in America. That part about the Pledge of Allegiance that says with liberty and justice for all, that's just a bunch of hooey. Because that simply doesn't exist in this country, all right? Number two, as far as organizing, I'm looking at this handbook, I'm going through it now, called Politics the Wellstone Way. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this.
Yes, I believe I've heard of it.
Okay. This book is how to elect, quote, progressive candidates and win on the issues, all right? And at the bottom of the title, it says, educate, advocate, and organize.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Focus on the message. All right. So anybody who really wants to get involved in quote progressive politics ought to pick this book up. I know you can get it at Laughing Horse. Okay. Number three. The United States of America is 49th in the world in literacy. Okay. Castro's little island of Cuba happens to be number one, by the way. All right. So why are we 49th in the world in literacy when we're supposed to be the richest country and we're supposed to turn out the best educated people? All right. I was talking to a teacher who pointed out to me that the hip-hop generation doesn't have the patience to sit down and read a book. What they want is instant gratification. And you cannot educate yourself through instant gratification. Okay?
Even though it's a little off track, I'd have to take issue with that. Because if you've listened to some of the lyrics of some of the artists, there is frequently allusions to concepts that cannot be grasped in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I can appreciate that for some of the more commercialized music, yes, it is very shallow. It doesn't stimulate your mind. It doesn't show any grasp of the language beyond being able to rhyme in basic rhyming patterns. But mm-hmm. if you listen to some of the non-commercial and some of the more successful folks that what you call conscious hip-hop,
mm-hmm.
you are listening to someone who has a grasp of social justice and injustice, of political sophistication with regard to quantum physics sometimes,
mm-hmm.
you know, and understanding of what the language has to offer in terms of versatility of meter and rhythm as well as content and significance of the words. I don't know. What do you think, Glenn?
No, I think the caller is generally correct.
Yeah.
There are always exceptions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings are wonderful. They're always coming up with something, and we're not carbon copies of each other. But there is a general consensus, and I'm talking about among, well, the black progressive educators that I know, who are my age and younger, that there is a lack of patience, a shorter attention span. Patience is probably a better word. There is a feeling that everything should come quicker and in a package. And so possibly we're not talking so much about attention spans, but a lack of patience, as the caller said. There is an expectation that all commodities and even knowledge, if looking at that as a commodity, should be delivered quickly and swiftly. And that's not something that an older generation is used to performing.
Well, thank you so much, caller.
Oh, thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too. You know, we're getting quick here out of time because I want to let you go because it is a holiday and appreciate your giving up some time. But one of the things I kind of wanted to touch on again was just the fact that with regard to the moral injustice of it, you don't really find a lot of political will coming out of this, I don't even know how to say it, this current milieu that really stands up and embraces the moral outrage as potently as it can with regard to our imperial overreach. I'm going to say overreach.
Black leadership has become a lobby.
Right.
As opposed to active organizers.
And a commodity.
Something to be bought and sold. Well, if you lobby, you get lobbied back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lobbying is a kind of conversation, but it's certainly not a movement. And lobbyists will never create movements. And our political class lobbies, and I mean electoral political, but so do most of our organizations. Rather than agitate, they lobby. That is their style of work, and I think it's based upon the particular class that they come from. But I'd like to mention Katrina, which is what another caller brought up, and
mm-hmm.
I felt so remiss in not talking about it. It's quite related to this conversation. In our last issue, our cover story was based on a study by a brilliant political scientist, Michael Dawson. He's now out of the University of Chicago. He's the most brilliant social demographer that I've ever encountered. And he does comparative studies between black political attitudes and white political attitudes. to show that there really is a difference in worldview. And in doing the study on Katrina, in which he found that most white people didn't think it said anything about the state of race relations in this country, and of course almost all black people said, yes, it did.
Indeed.
He said something that was very profound, I thought, and we put it in the lead paragraph of the story. He thinks that witnessing the Katrina phenomenon was a watershed, possibly a watershed historically, in black perceptions. And I'm going to quote him here. Katrina could very well shape this generation of young people in the same way that the assassinations of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King shaped our generation. And he says, it suggests to blacks the utter lack of the liberal possibility in the United States. I think that was quite profound, something that should really make people think. As soon as I witnessed the same images everyone else saw, I had a similar feeling to when I was standing on the banks of the Hudson River watching Tower Number 2 of the World Trade Center come down. And what came out of my mouth, and seemed to come out of everybody's mouth in the days that followed, was, everything has changed.
Yes.
And I felt that way with the Katrina phenomenon. And apparently Professor Dawson feels that way too. There are literally thousands of Katrina-related activities occurring in the black community. They are disconnected. They are not coordinated. People in the same city don't know that a church across town is doing Katrina work. But if you travel and you read, it's got to be thousands and thousands of Katrina-related activities. I'm reminded of the year 1965, when there were 10,000 separate protests and demonstrations across the country. Not coordinated. Nobody can coordinate 10,000 demonstrations. They were happening because of a general consciousness. And I think we have the potential with Katrina, with this generalized activity, uncoordinated, to see the beginnings of something that could, if worked correctly, turn into a movement. And certainly there has been an impact on the mass black consciousness, as Dr. Dawson alluded to.
Given the fact that this mass black consciousness that you describe and that Dr. Dawson has encompassed, what would it take to pull this together and to respond as we saw ourselves respond to King's moral imperative to make a change and to demand that this not be business as usual? Is there any other point that we can galvanize around?
Well, you know, we could go around talking about which issues to focus on, et cetera. That's work. But what's important here, and what every real organizer knows, is that people are changed by movements and political action. That is, once a person dives into a political project, they change. They start connecting the dots, as you said. Their own lives make more sense to them. Their own problems make more sense to them. And they see the commonality of their problems and other people's problems, and they start realizing that things can be done, and that they like impacting on their reality. They like struggle. People, you know, like to do good things.
Mm-hmm.
They really do. Many people are deluded into doing bad things by being told they're good.
Yes.
Their motivation usually is that they want to do a good thing. even if that means crusading against evolution. They think that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So just the basic fact of people being mobilized and masses of them being mobilized around Katrina, although this mobilization is not connected, it is disconnected, means there is the potential, if the right messages are presented that tie these folk together, and if the work is done to actually connect these many thousands of projects, there is the potential to have something that might look much like a movement.
But until then, we should not hold our breath. We should remember to do what was the words? Organize, educate, and make sure that we connect.
The images and the revelation, the eureka moment of Katrina, isn't going away.
Well, you know, we kind of ended up a little bit afield of discussing the whole issue of King, his faith, and the moral imperative and American imperialism, but not really. Not really. I think it comes to rest, as you said, in this watershed moment. And so part of, I think, his legacy will be how we choose to respond to this series of events, this ripple, this watershed moment.
Yes, and of course we've got real obstacles here, because as I believe we've spoken of in previous programs, the right and the entire corporate media are engaged in a campaign to create yet a new black leadership that is personified by Harold Ford, for example. They have already infested the Congressional Black Caucus so that we have 6 or 7 members who are totally subverted, bought out not necessarily by dollars but by the political apparatus of the right, by the corporate media coverage that is guaranteed if they break with the black political consensus. So we have a great internal problem to deal with, which makes it even more difficult to take advantage of that watershed event, Katrina, in order to galvanize and direct all of these thousands of projects that are now taking place.
Well, you know what that is? That's fodder for another conversation. I want to thank you so much for giving generously of your time. We've been speaking with Glenn Ford, who's co-publisher of theblackcommentator.com. You can visit it online at www.blackcommentator.com. Thanks so much for your time, Glenn.
Always good to be with you all.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we're going to close the show with a speech here from King. So often you've heard the mountaintop speech, but I pose this question here, and I have had some opportunity to discuss it with both Glenn and with callers as to how do we keep that moral edge, how do we look toward our spiritual strength to make a stand against not only imperialism abroad, but here in the country, so that we can have the country that really is truly liberty for one and for all. We're going to close with the speech from King called The Drum Major Instinct, and I want to thank you all for listening. And this has been More Talk Radio on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
And that is deep down within all of us an instinct. It's a kind of drum major instinct, a desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be first. And it is something that runs the whole gamut of life. And so before we condemn them, let us see that we all have the drum major instinct. We all want to be important, to surpass others, to achieve distinction, to lead the parade. Do you know that a lot of the race problem grows out of the drum major instinct, a need that some people have to feel superior a need that some people have to feel that they are first and to feel that their white skin ordained them to be first.
Let it plain to say, because I'm against it so heavily.
And they have said over and over again, in ways that we see with our own eyes. In fact, not too long ago, a man down in Mississippi said that God was a charter member of the White Citizens Council. And so, God being the charter member means that everybody who's in that has a kind of divinity, a kind of superiority. And think of what has happened in history as a result of this perverted use of the drum major instinct. It's led to the most tragic prejudice, the most tragic expressions of man's inhumanity to man. I mean, not only does this thing go into the racial struggle, it goes into the struggle between nations. And I would submit to you this morning that what is wrong in the world today is that the nations of the world are engaged in a bitter, colossal contest for supremacy. And if some doesn't happen to stop this trend, I'm sorely afraid that we won't be here to talk about Jesus Christ and about God and about brotherhood too many more years. If somebody doesn't bring an end to this suicidal thrust that we see in the world today, none of us are going to be around, because somebody's going to make the mistake through our senseless blunderings of dropping a nuclear bomb somewhere, and then another one is going to drop. And don't let anybody fool you. This can happen within a matter of seconds. Amen. They have 20 megaton bombs in Russia right now that can destroy a city as big as New York in 3 seconds, with everybody wiped away in every building. And we can do the same thing to Russia and China. But this is why we are drifting, and we are drifting there. Because nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world. And I am sad to say that the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America, because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken. God didn't call America to do what she's doing in the world now.
Preach it.
And we won't stop it because of our pride and our arrogance as a nation. But God has a way of even putting nations in their place.
Amen.
The God that I worship has a way of saying, don't play with me. He has a way of saying, as the God of the Old Testament used to say to the Hebrews, don't play with me, Israel. Don't play with me, Babylon.
Amen.
Be still and know that I'm God. And if you don't stop your reckless course, I'll rise up and break the backbone of your power.
Yes.
And that can happen to America.